Welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast, your audio source for what's going on in the Chicago theater scene. This is the episode for September 28th, 2009, and on this week's episode, Benno Nelson interviews the cast and fight director of Treasure Island at Lifeline Theater. Also, we have Chicago's theater news for you, so get ready and let's talk theater.
Welcome to Talk Theater in Chicago. I'm your host this week, Benno Nelson, and I'm here today with the cast and the fight director of Treasure Island, currently at Lifeline Theater. Let's get started and just introduce ourselves going around.
Sure. I'm Patrick Blaschel. I play Dr. Livesey in the show.
I'm Jeff Coates, and I'm the fight director.
I'm Rob McLean, and I play Captain Smollett and the pirate Harry.
I'm Chris Walsh. I play Billy Bones and Tom Redruth and George Mary.
Hey, I'm Sean Sinitsky playing Long John Silver.
Fantastic. And Robert, you're also the fight captain. Is that correct?
Great.
That's We'll get to talking about what that is. But first of all, I want to say congratulations to all of you for the production. It's fantastic.
Thank you.
A roaring success, and that's wonderful news. I think something that I'd like to get just sort of talking about is the fight choreography in the show. It's a big swashbuckling adventure and in a tiny little space. And I think that's part of the real sort of charm of this production.
Yeah.
And I think we can start really simply. Fight choreography and fight direction are two terms that get thrown around. Do you find them to be interchangeable?
There are multiple titles for what I do and for what a lot of these guys do.
Yeah, exactly. Christopher, you're also a fight director.
Yes.
They're interchangeable terms. It's fight director, fight choreographer, fight designer, violence designer. It all depends upon the preference. It hasn't been codified as yet. I prefer the term fight director.
Okay.
It's the simplest way to get the point across. But fight directors engage in fight choreography. It's oftentimes difficult when you're talking to someone who has very little concept of theater, or especially some of the esoteric design things in theater, of exactly what fight direction is. Because they'll ask me what I do in theater, and I say, I'm a fight director. And they say, oh, you land planes? Not flight. Flight. And then they have a strange look in their eye. They're like, oh, like fencing? Kinda. And then it leads into a lengthy discussion on that.
And then the fight captain is what you are. And talk a little bit about what that means, Robert.
The fight captain is responsible, once the show is open, for basically maintaining the fights. I run the fight call before every performance, where we just kind of mark through the fights at half speed or a little better than half speed, just so the first time you do a fight in any given night isn't in front of an audience, so you just kind of go through them all. If any issues have come up in previous shows, that's a chance to work through those. And as is the case with this show, we have some people that are getting worked into the cast after the fact. So then with myself and the stage manager and everyone else who's actually in the fights, we help bring the new people up to speed and maintain the weapons throughout the run of the show.
That's great. Actors in general, how do you guys feel about fights? Does anyone here hate being in fights or fear it?
Absolutely not. It's one of the most fun things, at least for me, one of the most fun things you can do on stage.
Yeah. Great.
And I've heard a lot of people talk, and a lot of times they're talking about fights in general, and I know that there's some other people that like to call themselves violence designers and that sort of thing, because then it goes outside of just fencing into any kind of landing blows, or if you're twisting somebody's arm, or you're doing anything like that to really kind of work those in. But it's great fun.
That's the general consensus.
I'd say so, definitely.
I feel like there's sometimes, I mean, we don't want to pick on anyone, but in my experience, it tends to be like one person in the cast who's like, I can't, like, I'm too old for this, or like,
oh, I don't want feel to that do I'm this, too old for it. I still have to do it.
None of us are as young as we are.
I think a lot of us, you know, showed up at the casting call for this show because we knew there'd be big fight scenes.
That's really interesting.
So I think, you know,
and it was cast with the idea in mind that the actors that were coming into audition had to have some form of fight experience.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't just have people who didn't know which end of the sword was sharp, but folks almost across the board who have had a great deal of experience, whether it's in classroom, whether it's in performance. Just over the years, I think the wealth of stage combat knowledge in this show surpasses most shows I've worked on.
Mm-hmm.
It's fantastic.
Makes my job easy.
That's
or
great.
Easier.
Yeah. Yeah, going around, like, what kind of experience do you guys have?
I studied stage combat at Columbia College.
Christopher, yeah.
And with David Woolley. And at the time, I had taken the, not certified, but it's like an actor combatant status.
Right.
You can get in different forms of weapons. Which,
yeah.
I haven't, kept up on that since school was over, but that was definitely how I got my start, and I'm mostly just kind of staying active, being in shows that have a lot of that tend to have a lot of violence involved, and also doing some choreography is what's helping me keep my skills sharp.
That's great.
I did the Society of American Fight Directors big summer workshop in Las Vegas
wonderful.
1992.
In 20th century.
Wow, yeah.
And that was the summer before I moved to Chicago, and had a blast with it and got my certification there, and then maintained the certification through these recertification classes.
Mm-hmm.
Served as a TA in different, teaching assistant in different fight stage combat classes. I've done a little choreography, but I prefer actually doing it and being, I'm a better fight coach than I am a fight captain, than I am a fight choreographer. So I like working on it in that capacity, doing it, and then the kind of, I like the maintaining it throughout the run of the show.
Which yeah, is
the perfect fight captain.
plus I'm only in one fight in this show, so that makes it easy for me to kind of be an outside eye.
Yeah.
And run the fight calls more effectively. It's hard to do if you're actually in all the fights, mm-hmm. to be a effective fight captain.
Yeah. Well, do you want to talk a little bit about, Jeff, about the challenges of having a sort of big vision in a small space? I mean, I think, just looking at the show, I think it's about as wide. This playing space is about as wide as, like, three of the muskets. And in one scene, I think you have six on stage.
Yeah.
So, yeah, what is that like? What
it's
does that
it's
mean?
A great challenge in this space. And I've worked with a couple of shows with Lifeline before. And the space is very deceptive. It looks small, but there's actually a great deal of space in
there.
One of the nice things about having experienced fighters in the show is that they can fine-tune their movements so as to give the illusion of danger for the audience when in fact they're missing the audience by at least 5 feet or more at times. So, and things are going so fast, sword blows are coming so quickly, especially when it's right in front of you, that it's all of a blur for the audience and they feel like they're on a roller coaster ride when they're still perfectly safe. Working in this space in particular, the sight lines are very nice. And by sight lines, I mean that the audience is not so wide that you have to worry about someone far over on house right seeing a blow from one angle,
mm-hmm.
or far over on house left seeing a blow from one angle, because it changes depending on the audience's perception.
Yeah.
With this one, the audience is fairly tight together in a nice line, so you can do a lot with the audience's eye in a space because it's controlled.
Mm-hmm.
And the other bonus is getting to work in the space. Nicely enough with Lifeline, right now we're sitting in the rehearsal studio, which is upstairs, and they have the performance space downstairs. We had the opportunity and the rare opportunity, that as soon as the set was built, we were able to get on that stage right away.
That's wonderful.
Which is usually what happens around tech, around the last week before the audience comes in to see the show, is when you are able to take the choreography that you designed in an outside space and plug it into the set. Which is always a tricky time, because usually you're doing your fight choreography on a flat surface like this room here,
mm-hmm.
and then you get into a multi-tiered, multi-angled stage, and all of a sudden fighters are having to remember their choreography while learning how to walk on very, very treacherous ground. Luckily, we got a great deal of time to rehearse on the set.
That's great.
Which just makes the fights even better. The more you practice, the better you're going to get.
It's one of the myriad bonuses of working at Lifeline is
yes.
how soon you get on the set.
Yeah.
Because you don't, it's not like working at a rental house where another show is moving out the day before you load in.
Yeah.
You don't have to rush your tech week.
Yeah.
And you really get to get acclimated to the stage in plenty of time.
Yeah. And that just makes for greater safety, which is the primary concern with fight choreography, and greater realism, which is the secondary concern. The more comfortable the actors are in the space, the better they're able to perform. The better they're able to perform, the better the show is. So having all of that time available is great, and having a supportive staff and a supportive environment as well. So the space is not nearly as restrictive as it might seem. It looks small, but it's deceptively large.
That's great.
Yeah.
That's perfect. There's a couple of sort of secrets of doing fights, I think, on stage that that audiences may not be aware of. I think the first you brought up with just sort of the role of the fight captain is that they can sort of deteriorate and that they need to be kept up, sort of kept fresh. Do you want to talk about that process at all?
It's like anything. People get lazy, you know, and, yeah. as a long run of a show keeps going, if you don't have the director watching it every night, mm-hmm. and if, especially at Lifeline, where the booth is situated in such a way that Erica, the stage manager, can really only see so much of the show. It's not like a lot of theaters where they have the kind of bird's eye view every night.
You can be hiding all kinds of bad acting back upstage.
Right. Exactly. So it just becomes, and because safety is such an issue with stage combat, both yeah. for ourselves as cast members and for in a space as close to the audience as Lifeline is, for the audience members as well. So it just really, it's really important for safety's sake and for storytelling's sake and mm-hmm. just for the sake of the show overall to make sure that a move that started out clean and precise stays clean and precise and doesn't start veering into sloppiness, which could lead into danger.
Right.
And also leads to messy storytelling. Yeah. If the fights aren't clean and precise, if they aren't performed exactly the way they were choreographed or exactly the way the actors intended them to, it changes the tone of the story.
Yeah.
A fight that is one night very exciting because the actors are right on their marks, the next night if they get a little sloppy, doesn't have the same impact.
Sure.
And so we're trying to recreate that dynamic every night. And that is where the role of the fight captain and the fight call come in, is to reintroduce the actors once again what we're doing, practice it one more time just so you have it in your muscle memory, just awaken those little cells.
At the same time, like unlike some other blocking that you kind of want to reach a point where you don't think about it anymore, mm-hmm. where you're no longer you're no longer surprised by what your feet are doing. There's a degree to which you still have to kind of maintain, at least from the audience's point of view, a sense that what's happening to you in this sudden fit of violence is unexpected, is a surprise to you. You can't look like this is a natural thing that happens to you all the time. You have to look like you're fighting.
And that's where the acting comes in. So it's not just about being a solid performer who can do choreography, but you also have to put the character and the intent behind it.
Yeah, I think that's really great. I think we can talk about this for a while. And one thing, Sean, I wanted to ask you about is that you have to fight as Long John with a wooden leg, and then you also fight without. And I think in general, something that we don't, just sort of talking about like the sort of dramaturgical aspects of fighting. In a musical, for instance, everyone sings, and you don't think that some people might not sing well, like that their character wouldn't sing well. That doesn't really come up.
Yeah.
But in fighting, I imagine it comes up all the time. A character might not be much of a fighter.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to fight these two really drastic, obvious ways. What was that like for you?
Well, we started up in here, and I remember during rehearsals, I was wearing a leg brace to remind me that, you know, this leg does not move.
Long John still has a wooden leg.
And, so it doesn't bend. And we were working on the killing of Trelawney. And I remember Jeff coming in and saying, we'll do this. And I'm like, I don't think I can because my leg doesn't bend.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, we adjusted that fight probably about four or five times and came up with something much better once the set was around. So, you know, when you're doing something like that, then, you got to make sure that you're isolating whatever limb it is that is affected so that you remember, because otherwise your body just automatically does stuff.
Or tries to. Yeah. That was the interesting thing about working with that wooden leg.
Yeah.
Was I can come up with a fight in my head around what a fighter with a wooden leg would do.
Yeah.
But Sean is there to tell me,
I can't do that.
So he's got the reality behind it and the responsibility of playing that side. The other thing I like about what Sean was doing with this, and this comes across with the character as well, is a multifaceted character as Long John. He's not just what you assume he's going to be. Same thing with that leg.
Mm-hmm.
The character is actually very mobile.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In the book, they talk about him being very, limber, and, you know, and he uses that as sort of like a surprise tactic. You know, he can look like he's more lame than he is,
yes.
And so people will then drop their guard and then whoop.
Yeah.
Don't turn your back on him.
Yeah.
One of my favorite sort of even just physical moments in this show, maybe moments in general in the show, is with all the running around and all of the acrobatics, the scene of Long John trying to get to his crutch is so sort of simple and so physical and I don't know, I just thought it was a great moment. Do you
have anything? Well, I mean, that's right from the book because the captain uses that to basically humiliate him, which is probably a bad idea with Long John.
Yeah. Didn't work out well for Nathan.
It certainly didn't, you know. And I think that's interesting. That is like the one place where he is vulnerable. Is it, you know, technically it's supposed to be sand. We can't show that on stage. But he can do a lot of things on hard surfaces. But once he's in sand, he's kind of screwed.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah. And we also worked a lot with Sean, and Sean worked a lot himself and brought a lot to the table with how to deal with the crutch.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And using that not only as a method of supporting his leg, but also using it as an object to, we use it in a fight at one time. That it's not just there as a cane, but it's actually another limb.
Yeah.
So it's another hand.
Yeah,
another
that's great.
The hardest part was figuring out how to get up and down stairs. How would he do that?
And you do that lickety-split.
Yeah. You don't mess around with those stairs.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, in the book, it talks about him hopping around everywhere and being very adept at it.
Yeah.
So I'm like, I've got to try and find a way to do that.
You know?
Like, thankfully, once the stage was built, there was enough surface area for me to put a hand for balance, and then I can hop up and down stairs.
As long as you avoid those certain holes on the set.
Really?
Mighty. Yeah, well, the ship has, you know, deck hatches.
Those
were solid all through rehearsal until about the
last preview.
I walk in, and there's holes drilled through all of them, and I look at the
perfectly sized
for the crutch, and I look at the director, I'm like, you really hate me, don't you? So far, I found them every night. I found a hole. It's like, whoop,
there it goes.
Yeah, so that's a real pain in the butt.
Well, your safety is a worthy sacrifice for a cool lighting.
Well, I mean, the thing that's great about it is I actually can put weight on the leg, so I only put weight on the crutch where I know there's not holes.
Oh, that's funny. Because
whenever I'm walking across that surface, I always feel it slipping, so that way, you know. Right.
Yeah, I don't know. It'd be funny.
For you, maybe.
With like a bowler hat, too.
Well, the crutch made it down like halfway down one of those holes one night.
Oh, yeah, my God.
Yeah. I think got shorter.
About 3-4 feet. Like, yeah. Whoa!
That's real, right? That would happen on a boat.
It just might.
Oh, sure. You know,
unfortunately, during that scene, we're not on the boat.
Yeah.
Those are the great moments that you have to play when you're on stage.
Yeah.
You can't just go, I'm sorry, audience.
That didn't happen. Oh, it did.
It did.
Yeah.
This is
the
reality of the character. The character happened to find a hole in the deck, and there goes the crutch.
I think I noticed one of those moments with a musket misfiring the night that I saw it. Mm-hmm. And it was one of those, I think, I forget who it was, but just looked at the musket and was like, stupid thing, never works. And it was just exactly, you couldn't but believe, you could tell half the audience was like, what a great little moment.
Yeah. We actually have one of those moments built in for Chris here, the Billy Bum's Black Dog fight, where he pulls out a pistol halfway through the fight.
Yeah.
Audience thinking the fight's about to be done, and on purpose, the gun does not go off.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing about using stage guns, just like real guns, they're not always going to work when you want them to.
Oh, man, Inishmore.
So the backup plan always is, if the gun doesn't work, same thing your character would do if your gun didn't work. You find something else to do really quick, like pull out your sword or try and reload it. But there's always a possibility, and that lends the air of reality to it, rather than all of these guns working perfectly every time.
Right, no one ever has to reload, like in movies.
Right.
So I think we can keep talking a little bit about just sort of the dramaturgy of fight choreography. You use the phrase I really like a lot, like causality of conflict. That's beautiful. I think that works in a lot of ways. Do you want to sort of talk about what that means to you?
Yeah, for me it means not just having a scene be about the fight, but it's about what happens before the fight and what happens after the fight. A metaphor that I oftentimes use is one of the things I don't like about most musicals, not all musicals, mind you, but most musicals, is oftentimes you will see they will act and act and act and then stop and then sing.
Yeah.
Rather than making a smooth transition. Rarely do you see people walking down the street breaking into song. They have to be moved into singing. Mm-hmm. Something emotional happens within their lives at that moment and they feel that urge and it wells up within them and poof, out it comes in song. Same thing happens with fights. You don't go 0 to 60 in a fight. What you do is, you get a little bit tense, and then you get a little bit more tense, and you build up that tension, and you build up that tension to the point where the audience sees it, feels it, and goes, oh my God, there's a fight about to happen, but they don't know when it's about to happen, and then it explodes when they least expect it.
Yeah.
So that's the lead-in to it. It's very important. You have to lead up to a fight, and the audience needs to see the character starting to boil over, reasons why you're getting into a fight. Then also you need to think about what happens after the fight. How does the victim feel after having lost?
Yeah.
Even more possibly, they're dead. How does the attacker feel? I always dislike Schwarzenegger movies for this very reason, especially his earlier ones. Like, for example, in Commando.
He walks into a place with his very large machine gun and mows down 30 guys, says something pithy, and walks out. All of these guys had families, had brothers, sisters, mothers, daughters, family, friends that were either relying upon them or not relying upon them. They had lives and interactions. We never see who these people are. You never get a chance to know who they are.
Right.
You don't see what happens to Schwarzenegger after he's done. How does he feel about having killed a lot of people? This will have an emotional impact on anyone. Anyone who's ever gone into battle will tell you that it's the worst possible thing in the world. The glory goes right out the window. They have all kinds of problems. Post-traumatic stress disorder is directly related to what happens after violence.
Yeah.
So being able to show that in the characters on stage, when they come into a fight, they have a reason to fight and the audience can see it. They fight naturally and they fight realistically and they fight desperately to stay alive. And then they have an emotional reaction afterwards. And this creates a story arc. And that's so much more interesting to watch on stage than acting, 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 break a fight, and then go right back to it with no consequences whatsoever.
Yeah, because you can see really good fights, and I've seen mm-hmm. really good fights and people that are technically really adept, but it doesn't do anything for me because there's no danger. It's like, okay, step mm-hmm. here, step there, step there.
Right.
Yeah, Jeff was really good about this from the beginning, and every time I work with you, you've always really made that point clear. There's danger involved. There's a different way that characters will react to this sort of thing. You know, my character acts much differently than the pirates do.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
So we try to bring a lot of that into it. And it just makes for it to be more exciting. And it's just so much more fun and thrilling to do.
And it continues the story so that the fight is not a break from the story.
Yeah.
It's a continuation of the story. And it changes the way the story goes. The fight has a definite impact, no pun intended, on the story from there on out. If that fight didn't happen, the story would have taken a different path. But it did. And these characters grow and they change because of what happens with their interactions, whether it's through conflict, whether it's emotional or verbal or physical conflict. Some form or another, it's going to change that character. And seeing that change and highlighting conflict, which is the soul of drama, I think, it makes for vastly greater storytelling.
Yeah, I'm glad that you mentioned musicals, because I don't know why, but in thinking about fight choreography, I do think about it like a musical. And there's something about exactly that. You know, we say a good musical, the song moves the plot along in some way. And thinking about violence, I think, obviously does that.
Yeah, yeah. Plus, and it's oftentimes interesting to I don't always throw in a fight where a fight is written into the script. Mm-hmm. There are different ways of exploring conflict that don't have to deal with physical violence. It's almost more interesting to see an almost fight and have it not happen. For example, like if you're sitting in church with a bunch of your friends and somebody actually I was going to say tells a joke or lets a fart slip or something like that, and you want to laugh, you're trying so hard not to laugh, and everybody else feels that and they all trying to keep it quiet, it's trying not to do something and failing miserably, which is much more interesting than a burst of laughter in church. Mm-hmm. It's trying not to fight and having no other choice but to fight rather than, and now we're going to fight and there's no care for it and it's just there because the fight director told me to.
If you don't mind, I'd like to talk about Dr. Livesey just a little bit. Again, sort of talking about this, the specificity that's possible with this violence. Where did he learn to fight? And does he like fighting? And how does that influence the way that you carry a sword in a fight? You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. He, the character himself, he was Army. Mm-hmm. Before he became a doctor. I don't know too much more about that. You know, I've kind of built my own backstory of what he is, but he was in the Army. He was involved in a war, so he has some experience in there. He's got a strong dislike for pirates and anybody else who's against the law, which is a really nice area for me to play in because everybody else is a pirate. And he really seems to me to be the kind of guy that would not want to be involved in it at all, if at all possible.
Right.
He's a very intellectual guy, very smart. So that when it comes to fighting, it's really last resort for him. And he's going to get into soldier mode. So when Smollett is telling us, you know, getting quarters, okay, I know exactly what to do.
Yeah.
And it's just that little switch that's flipped in him. What's nice, I only have one fight, and it's the big fight where everybody fights in there. It's nice to be able to get out there and just, you know, let him go nuts. But it's he's very controlled in a way. You know, he knows exactly where he wants to go. Mm-hmm. And there's a nice moment where he stops a blow to save boy Jim.
Yeah.
What was also interesting to me in the end is that I realized I don't actually kill anybody.
Right. That's great.
Really? No.
Yeah.
And I don't kill anybody in the whole show. I was like,
but as a consequence, you have people killed.
I do. But, you know, one I hold up for John to shoot and one I Rob shoots at the end.
Yeah. So you kind of help with the killing.
I do. I think, you know, he wouldn't do it, you know, offhand. It wouldn't be somebody that would be his plan B or plan C.
Uh-huh.
So I find that kind of interesting, not wanting to be involved in it, but when he's going to be involved in it, he's going to, you know, rely on his training. So I kind of look at it that
yeah.
way.
I guess I think that's such an interesting difference, because when you think about, I mean, choreography sounds like dance, and it sounds like you're a bunch of guys out there hitting your marks every night. And the
with jazz.
With jazz. It's huge.
Jazz.
But the idea that, like, that you have to come at it as Lizzie, it was such a different sort of point of view than, like, Billy Bones, for whom violence, I imagine, you have a completely different relationship with.
I'd imagine that's entirely accurate. I think that, I mean, for Billy Bones specifically, my personal approach was that he reacts mostly out of fear. He's highly paranoid. He's being pursued by the other pirates because he, you know, he knows where the treasure is and that sort of thing. So his reactions in all the situations that he reacts in are entirely to suppress any sort of attention coming to him, that sort of thing. The first time he meets Dr. Livesey, and he overreacts being drunk, and then when Livesey informs him that he's actually a magistrate, Billy Bones' reaction is to completely shut down and not call any more attention to himself.
Interesting.
And his fighting style that, you know, that Jeff thought of and we developed was that pretty much every move he makes is what he hopes is the killing blow.
Yeah.
He wants to end it immediately. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of, yeah, that's the approach that we took with him.
Fast and dirty and then get out and go hide again.
Yeah.
And that's good. And I think I just sort of want to hit that again. It's just the idea that you're really not, well, one, you're working with a choreographer who's sensitive to that, a director who's sensitive to that. Mm-hmm. But the idea that you can't just go in and hit those points.
Right.
But you do, as actors, it's important to bring all the rest into it, and that the way that you're fighting and the manner in which you're fighting, because even the other characters that you play are so different than Billy Bones.
Yeah.
And even the pirate.
Yeah, they're very different. I think George Merry is the other pirate I play, and he's much smarter.
Yeah.
He's a bit more conniving than Billy Bones ever was, but at the same time doesn't have the managerial skills, I think,
that he believes that he has.
That he believes he has. And, you know, and you really don't see George Merry fight much at all.
Right.
He
runs on and, like, swings something.
There's a little bit.
But he does die gloriously.
He dies. He has a fantastic death. I love it. But, he carries a gun. He doesn't, you don't really see him get up close and personal fighting. He threatens to. Mm-hmm. Mostly I have the advantage of being the one other cast member as big as Sean.
Yeah.
So we can actually kind of...
two legs.
So we can actually get close to eye to eye. I get that moment that I enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, George is a guy who feels he doesn't have to do a lot of work because he's big enough that people will just do what he asks.
That's great. That's really great. I think the other thing we can talk about just for a little bit, I think we have a little bit more time, is the sort of secrets of fight direction and of performing fights on stage. It's one of those realms that we were talking about a little bit before. It just it's like a little bit magic. And it's one of those willful suspensions of disbelief that everyone in the audience is... It's one of those for last ones that we all really kind of go for, I think.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you want to, like, reveal any secrets or talk about it, but one thing that I just think is funny is, in fight direction, the trick is you don't shoot him. You know, you don't cut him.
Right.
But it's so much more complicated than that.
It is. And it takes a great deal of skill to be able to maintain that sense of illusion.
Yeah.
This is not something that you can just jump right into. It is as complicated and requiring as much study as any martial arts does. Mm-hmm. The more you do it, the better you're going to be at it. When you start right off the bat, you're not going to know the length of your own arm. You have to have a sense, as a performer, a sense of body awareness, mm-hmm. how long your arm is in space, so that you can swing it with abandon and still miss by choice.
Right.
Some of the tricks that we use are you miss your partner by 6 to 8 inches. Mm-hmm. Every time you're doing any kind of blow, 6 to 8 inches, that creates a barrier of safety. Another trick is rehearsal. Over and over and over and over and over again. It's 5 hours of rehearsal for every 1 minute of fighting. Wow. And that takes a great deal of time. That's just so you can get it into your muscle memory. Tricks that we use after that are, well, it's sort of in stage combat and fight choreography is sort of a combination of martial arts, stunt work, and illusion and mime work. Mm-hmm. So we use all of these aspects in it. Especially with illusion, we're getting you to look somewhere else while we do something. By the time you look back at what I'm doing, so if I'm doing something with my right hand to distract you, I'm about to do something with my left hand. By the time you look at my left hand, it's already done and you see the reaction to it.
Yeah.
One of the main things that helps out when this is having a good partner. In stage combat, the victim is always in control. So that this maintains actor safety.
Yeah.
So that if I'm going to punch Rob and I'm the attacker, he's the victim. Rob is going to choose when he avoids out of the way. If Rob doesn't avoid my punch, I'm not allowed to throw my punch. Mm-hmm. Rob has the control. He's the victim. And something else that works out really well is a thought process that has to go into all actors is that you cannot make yourself look good in a fight. You can only make your partner look good. Mm. Your partner's job is to make you look good. This not only maintains good partnering skills, which will add to the greater degree of fighting, but also keeps you from being too selfish. If I'm on stage and I'm going to make my fight look really good, and Rob is my partner on this one, and I throw a huge haymaker punch, and Rob has a very tiny reaction to it, rather than having the reaction that we would normally expect from a huge punch, he then has made me look weaker.
Yeah.
He doesn't look any weaker. He actually looks stronger.
Right.
But he's made me look weaker. In this sense, then, the partnering has to come into effect. There's always a cause and effect. It's just like in physics. If I'm going to throw a punch, there's got to be some reaction to it. And depending on the way you want the style of the fight to go, that depends on what the reaction is going to be. So, for example, if I throw a really big punch and Rob reacts very small, mm-hmm. it's going to be superhero. If I throw a very small punch and he reacts very big, it's again going to be superhero. So you can change how you want all of this to be done. Everything else underneath that, where the illusion and the mime work comes into gear, is a lot of about body tension, how you look on stage. If, for example, when we're doing a choke on stage, my hands don't actually go around the actor's throat. My hands create a cage around their throat, which has a gap of about 3 inches into it. Now, if the audience were to look at that gap very closely, they'd see the gap that's lying there and realize that I'm not actually choking him. So what my partner would do in that sense is take their hands and cover over mine, filling in the gap, creating a barrier of safety, and then all I have to do as the attacker is choking is just put tension into my arms and shake a little bit.
Yeah.
Pretend it. I've done this on a cat before.
Wow.
Pick up a cat. Cat loves me. This cat loves me. Pick up a cat, put my hands around the cat's head, and I pretend to squeeze, and the cat's sitting there and having a great time. And I was like, oh my God, what are you doing to this poor cat? Because I'm shaking just subtly, creating a cage, and it looks like I'm crushing him, when in fact, I'm not putting any pressure whatsoever. And the cat comes off and goes and eats some food. It's all about illusion. It's all about intention behind it, and acting is where that really comes into key.
Something that I remember being told doing fights is that speed doesn't matter. The blade.
Yeah, that's definitely, yeah. There's a thing, a sci-fi thing, called the Uncanny Valley. I don't know if you're familiar with this. The idea that when things begin to look too realistic, they stop looking realistic. It's a popular thing with like CGI going on right now. Creating animation that looks too human, it starts to look creepy instead of human. And I think there's something similar to that with fight choreography, where once there's a point where if it gets too realistic on stage, the audience stops watching the play and starts wondering when the actors are going to get
hurt. That's so true.
Yes.
And it detracts from the entertainment value.
It's keeping in mind that there is, what we're doing on stage is heightened reality. We're not really playing pirates. If I'm in Hamlet, I'm not actually Hamlet. I'm not actually in Denmark.
Yeah.
I'm pretending to be. I'm heightening the reality. And so it's that suspension of disbelief that every audience member brings with them into the show, that if you give them just enough reality, their imagination will fill in the rest. Mm-hmm. If you take away their ability to imagine it and give them reality, their brain is going to try and figure out what's wrong with the situation, and what they're going to do is realize that the actors are in danger, and it takes them out of the moment, and they're scared for the actors, and then they become scared for themselves.
Right.
And that's the last thing you want. You want them to be entertained and come along for the ride. You want them to certainly have an emotional reaction, but fear is not the reaction they're going for.
You were talking, too, about the different tricks and different types of things that go on. In this show, too, I think a lot of it has to come down with what kind of weapons you have. I mean, we have so many different
so many
types
styles.
Of weapons.
Yeah.
We've got big, long knives. We've got short knives. Yeah. We've got rapiers. We've got muskets. How are you going to do each one? Each one has its own characteristics.
Yeah.
How much tension can I hold on that?
Yeah.
And that comes through when we do a fight call. Dry saying, you know, that one's hitting too hard. And I see Rob's always getting all the burrs out of the things as we start hitting them too much. So it really depends, too. I mean, when you're working just hand-to-hand combat and that sort of thing, it's... you know, my fighting Jean, he's taller than I am. He's got a longer reach. So that's going to change the way that we do that.
Yeah.
And also in terms of speed that you had mentioned, once you get to a certain point, too much speed will take away the story of the fight.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And what is more important, once you get to a speed that looks believable on stage, is making sure that there's clarity of intention and that everyone can tell who's attacking, who's defending, and what the results of that move are. And if you can't tell those things, then the fight's going too fast and it's no longer telling the story. Yeah. And then it's not as good.
I oftentimes will watch Olympic fencing just to try and steal moves and just find it.
Nice.
But I can't follow 90% of what they're doing. It's so fast. It's so beautiful and amazing and skilled and talented, but it's not done for the audience's viewing.
Right.
It's done for scoring. Mm-hmm. We are here for the audience's viewing, and human beings can go faster than a human eye can follow. That's one of the great things about what magic comes into it, is that we can go do things so quickly that you can't follow what I'm doing, and by the time I've done my trick, you're still trying to catch up.
Yeah.
So we have to slow things down just enough that the audience can follow along with the story rather than following behind it.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you don't want to go so slow that the audience sees a punch coming a mile away.
Right, yeah.
So what you do is... the big trick, say, in a punch is not so much what happens at the moment of contact or stage combat contact, but what happens before and what happens after.
Mm-hmm.
So that when you're throwing a punch, you do a big windup, and the audience sees the big windup, you do a fast punch, and then you see the reaction of the victim afterwards. So it's the before and the after, just like we were talking about with the causality of conflict. The before and the after are just as important, sometimes more important than what's actually happening at the moment.
Yeah.
Creating that whole story in there. So those are some of the tricks we use. We also use fake blades.
Yeah.
That's number one. There are no intentionally sharp edges on these blades. As Patrick said, oftentimes these blades getting banged together, they are steel, and so they will get nicks and burrs on them. And one of Rob's jobs, lucky him, as a fight captain, is shaving the burrs off of the weapon so that they are safe for the actors to use, because they can become serrated and you can get cuts on yourself.
I put an edge on one blade every night and didn't figure out.
So tell them which one.
Treasure Island roulette.
Yeah.
And the bullets are real. And if you want to disprove that, you have to come see the show.
You gotta dare to stand in front of that gun.
Yeah, exactly. Lifeline Theater through November 1st. Thank you all so much for sitting down and talking with me.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Great fun.
Hello, Chicago, and welcome to the Talk Theater in Chicago News Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Moat, bringing you the theater news for the week of September 28th, 2009. Looking Glass Theater Company opens its 22nd season with the wickedly dark comedy, Phaedra, Queen of Haiti. The show is written by ensemble member J. Nicole Brooks and directed by ensemble member Laura Eason. It is a Looking Glass original production, and it runs from September 30th through November 15th at the Looking Glass Theater Company, which is located inside of Chicago's historic Water Tower Waterworks. This will be Looking Glass's 51st world premiere, and it is an explosive retelling of the Greek myth Phaedra. It's a story of power and desire set in a reimagined Haiti that stands as the world's greatest superpower. Tickets for the Looking Glass original Phaedra, Queen of Haiti, are currently available. For information on how to get those tickets, click on over to theaterinchicago.com. Profiles Theater opens its 21st anniversary season with the Midwest premiere of the Neil LaBute drama, The Mercy Seat. The production runs through November 15th at the Profiles Theater. In a time of national tragedy, the world changes overnight. The Mercy Seat was one of the first major theatrical responses to the September 11th attacks back in 2001. The show premiered in December of 2002 to critical success. LaBute presents the brutal realities and explores whether one can be truly opportunistic in a time of universal selflessness. This is Profiles Theater's seventh Midwest premiere of one of Mr. LaBute's work. The Mercy Seat will be followed this season by Tracy Letts' modern classic Killer Joe, that will start on January 8th, and Ellen Ferry's Graceland, which celebrated its world premiere at Profiles back in May, will continue its run through November 15th as well. Tickets for The Mercy Seat are currently available. Click on over to theaterinchicago.com to find out how to get them. The Steppenwolf Theatre Company's production of August, Osage County, is headed to Australia. They've already presented on Broadway and at Britain's National Theatre, and now they're headed down under. Steppenwolf announced that it will perform Tracy Letts' play at the Sydney Theatre Company next summer for a one-month engagement that will be from August 13th through September 12th of next year. It will be the original Broadway production with all the designers on board, but the show has yet to be cast. Stay tuned to Theatre in Chicago's auditions page. You may have an opportunity to be a part of it. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago News podcast. Remember, you can find us here every Monday with more news ready for you to enjoy. So, until next Monday, that is the theater news from Talk Theater in Chicago, and I'm your host, Dustin Moat. Thank you for listening to the Talk Theater in Chicago podcast. I would like to thank our guests for giving us the honor of interviewing them this week. I would also like to thank Benno Nelson and Mark Meyer. Without them, this podcast would not be possible. And I would also like to thank you, our listening audience. Remember, we will be here every Monday with a new episode ready for your listening pleasure. So, until next Monday, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you, Chicago, to keep talking theater.